bring up some teachings of Dogen. And this morning I want to talk about his famous fascicle, which appears as fascicle 9 in Kastanahashi, his two volume, I think now they reissued it as one volume, Shobo Genzo translation, Bowing to Attain the Marrow. It's about bowing, the practice of bowing, which is not something we do too much ordinarily in Western culture, where we greet each other by shaking hands. Nowadays, especially where I come from, we hug one another. And it's pretty nice, person to person, warm greeting. But in Buddha Dharma, we have the custom of bowing, which is feels very different from this. It probably seems to us, if we're not used to bowing, that it's a little formal and artificial. Certainly, we can feel intuitively that bowing has a certain quality of distance to it, right? Because we don't touch one another, and there's a space that remains between us when we bow, and we both of us bow into that space. So there's some kind of quality of distance to it, and a certain sense of formal respect, maybe even reverence, you know, when you bow to someone. So we might bow to one another. Also, we might bow to someone who is not bowing back to us, like when we bow to the Buddha on the altar, who seems to be just sitting there, not bowing back. In this case, the bow is an expression of deep reverence. We could even say it's an expression of faith, which means letting go of ourselves to receive the other, or as I think we understand in Zen, identification with that to which we're bowing, which we reverence. So now we're not talking anymore about greeting, we're talking about bowing as a spiritual practice. And this is what Dogen is writing about in his fascicle. And he starts off by talking about the one to whom we bow. So he begins by talking about Dharma teachers and how important it is in practice to have Dharma teachers. And he writes, in the practice of unsurpassable complete enlightenment, what is most difficult to find is a guiding teacher. The guiding teacher should be a strong person, regardless of being male or female. The teacher should be a person of thusness, with excellent knowledge and wild fox spirit, whether living in the past or present. This is the face of attaining the marrow, the guiding virtue. This is not ignoring cause and effect. This is you and I are just this. So he's saying a whole lot of stuff in that short paragraph. First of all, he's telling us what we should look for in a teacher, that he or she be strong and stable and steady, that he or she or they would be a person of thusness, which make a long story short, we could say, in this case, that that means a person who is true to the practice, with unshakable faith in it, and also in this is very straightforward, that they are just as they are, an open book, that they don't have something to prove or gain from the practice. And the person should also be, he's saying, a kind of catalyst for your own transformation. That's what the wild fox spirit is. In Asia, the wild fox spirit is a shape shifter. The fox can appear in all sorts of ways, can transform itself in all sorts of ways, and so the fox can effect transformation in others. And this means that the teacher should be inspiring enough to you to be an example, someone that you can emulate, someone who somehow resonates with a deep image that you have already in your own heart. And this is the face, he says, of attaining the marrow. So it's an interesting way he puts this. It's not a matter of, you know, knowledge or skill you need. You need a face. This is what it looks like to attain the marrow, the most intimate teaching of the Buddha. That the teacher would be able to help you go beyond yourself so that you could touch your true self. Maybe you noticed he also says the teacher might be living in the past or present. I guess he means that somehow we have a teacher who is no longer alive. That could mean that we have a teacher that we knew who passed away and remains our teacher. Or maybe it could mean that we have a teacher from the past that we've never met. Like, in that sense, somebody could say, well, Suzuki Roshi is really my teacher, because when I ran Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, I was so moved by it. It spoke to me so much. Or we could say, maybe more in a more primary way, that the Buddha is our teacher. And I think, actually, that is the idea. The Buddha is our teacher, all of us. And whoever is the living teacher is just an access point, a living, breathing, imperfect, of course, because they're alive, access point to our dear teacher, our real teacher. Then he says the teacher should be a person who is, does not ignore cause and effect, and is, you and I are just this. So many of you will recognize these phrases as not Dogen's phrases, but short phrases that reference two really important teachings that Dogen often mentions. The first one, not ignoring cause and effect, I think became increasingly important for Dogen as he grew older. It's from the famous Baizhang's Fox Koan. It means that a teacher, an awakened person, is true to cause and effect, true to precepts and ethical conduct, the deep respect for how things unfold in this world, and especially, because of this, true to kindness and compassion. The second phrase, you and I are just this, refers to a deeper and broader view that practice is beyond all forms of limitation and narrowness, and beyond all definitions. As soon as you think you have figured the practice out, you know you're wrong. Because practice is bigger than anything you could figure out. It includes everything and everyone. And there is nothing outside the realm of practice. And Zazen itself expresses this limitlessness and actualizes it in our life. Also, you may have been aware that he said the person should be a strong person, male or female. Maybe that struck you when you heard Dogen say that. Dogen is saying this in the 13th century in Japan, a very patriarchal world. The world is still pretty patriarchal in some places, much more than others. We hope and pray very little patriarchal in our Western Buddhist culture. Anyway, we hope so. But for sure, in 13th century Japan, this was full-on patriarchy. So it's kind of amazing, really, that Dogen would say, irrespective, it doesn't matter, male or female. In fact, the idea that female teachers ought to be respected equally with male teachers is one of the main points in this fascicle. We'll get to that a little bit later. I think it's the reason why, as we read on, you realize that the reason why Dogen wrote this is because he was very upset about people who missed this point. But we'll get to that in a minute. Right now, the point is, it's hard to find a teacher that you can have confidence in. If you're lucky enough to find one, you should revere that teacher with gratitude. And that's what you do when you bow. You're practicing reverence and respect. It's a practice of cultivating reverence and respect, this bowing. And that's why we need to have someone we can confidently bow to. He says, "You attain the marrow and are invariably transmitted Dharma through your utmost sincerity and trusting heart. There is no path that comes from anything other than sincere trust. There is no direction that emerges from itself." And I so much love this teaching of Dogen. You know, everything in this world, it seems, is quantified and codified, and it's all about accumulation and performance, getting it right, doing it right. Our practice is not about accomplishment or transcendence. It's not about being a sage or a special person. It's really about trust. It's about the cultivation of a trusting heart. This has always been something human beings have prized and needed. And maybe now more than ever, when a trusting heart seems harder to come by. And the world is so drastic and seemingly so difficult. And there are so many great reasons to be cynical, distrustful, disappointed in every, you know, figure of authority. Now more than ever, we really need to have a trusting heart and a confident heart. And trust is trust in something. Trust is relational and interactive. As he writes, there is no direction that emerges by itself. Of course, we have to trust ourselves, but if we trust ourselves only, we are narcissistic. We're living in a kind of bubble of our own making. And in the end, we can rest assured that bubble is going to pop, and we're going to be suffering a lot and making other people suffer. To have real trust in oneself requires that we be able to trust another, but not just another. Every other, every rock, tree, patch of sky, and person. We trust each person to completely and truly be who they are. And that's why a teacher is so important and so transformative for us, because through trusting the teacher, we come to trust ourself and the whole of life. So as I say, the teacher is the occasion for awakening that trusting heart that's already in us, but has been covered over so much by our wounds and what's happened to us that we can't find it. In other words, the teacher is an occasion, not a person, that we're supposed to revere as such. We have to understand that reverence for the teacher is the occasion of reverence for all beings. If we make the teacher into an icon, a special person, you know, more special than ourselves, more special than other persons and beings, we have lost our teacher and created the conditions for suffering. And this happens a lot. That's not what he's talking about here. He then says, you should understand the Dharma as weighty and your own body as light. And you retreat from the world and make your way and make the way your home. If you consider your own body weightier than the Dharma, Dharma is not transmitted to you, and you will not be able to attain the way. In other words, he's saying, make practice your whole purpose and invest practice with all your love. Instead of thinking that practice is something you are doing for the benefit of you and your life, and you're worried about your life and how it's going to turn out, whether or not you're going to be happy and get what you need and well satisfied and receive the fruits of the practice or not. Just liberate yourself from all of these essentially painful considerations and throw yourself into the house of Buddha right away. Make practice your only concern, and you can rest assured that one way or the other, your life is going to be fine. You don't have to try to make it be fine. Now, I want to make sure that you're not misunderstanding me here, because this is, with Dogen, you know, things are not always exactly as they seem. I don't think Dogen means that you should quit your job on Monday, tomorrow. You heard the Dharma talk and now you're resigning from your position. And by the way, sorry, family, but I'm leaving and going to the Zen Center now, throwing my whole life into the house of Buddha. I mean, look, if you feel like doing that on Monday, you should. You have a lousy job and the pay is no good and your family members are abusive. Good idea, you go to the Zen Center. It's a good thing to do, don't get me wrong. It's a good thing to do, go to the Zen Center and, you know, throw away your life and just practice. But I don't think that that's exactly what he's saying. Because when Dogen talks about practice, he doesn't mean simply formal practice. Formal practice is the occasion for practice, but it is not the literality of practice. Formal practice is necessary, it's part of what we do. But practice is more than that. Practice is a whole way of being in the world, a way of understanding the world, an attitude in the world, in our living, that pervades our whole life, every single thing that we do or think is our practice. So practice involves our livelihood, our work life, all our relationships. It involves the cultivation of many virtues like kindness, loyalty, sincerity, wholeheartedness, devotion, caring, compassion. All of that is practice. And sometimes you run off to a retreat, and it's a very selfish thing to do. You know, it's not practice. So Dogen is not saying here that we should only do formal practice all of the time. He's telling us that we should radically reorient our lives. Orient our lives away from self-interest and self-concern, and really toward others and concern for the world. Away from pleasures and distractions, and toward insight, clarity, and kindness. He says, the aspiration for making Dharma weighty is not limited to a single path and does not depend on instructions from others. In other words, as I'm saying, it's an inner matter and it may take many forms. And even though he's just been telling you how important it is to have a teacher, here he's saying this is not a matter of getting instructions. You know, the teacher's going to tell you what to do, or even how to practice exactly. Nobody can tell us how to live our lives but ourselves. That's not the point of the teacher. He goes on to explain more. Regarding Dharma as weighty means this. If you encounter someone who maintains the great Dharma, having received the acknowledgement, you have attained my marrow, whether that person is a pillar, or a lantern, or a Buddha, or a wild fox, a demon, a man or a woman, you should keep your body and mind on the Zazen seat and attend to the person, even for immeasurable eons. It is common to attain body and mind, which are just like widely spread rice plants, flax, bamboo, or reed. But it is rare to encounter Dharma. So here, to disabuse us from the idea that our teacher is a great and special person, he says, well, your teacher might be a pillar or a lamppost, a fox. Your teacher might even be a demon. It doesn't matter, really, how great or ungreat the teacher is. People think, no, you know, I think I want a teacher, I better find the top-notch teacher that I can find, you know, with the best credentials. That's not the point. The point is, this is a person for you who is a vehicle for the trusting heart to be developed. And he says, once you find such a person, first, keep sitting. And second, keep on giving her your trust. Recognize how precious and rare it is that you have found a way to enter into such a relationship. Meaning, you have found a way to crack open your own heart so that finally you can begin your real life. And then he starts talking very directly now about bowing. And now the point is that he said all this in advance to make it clear what he's talking about, what bowing is really about. Bowing is an expression of this feeling of trust and reverence and love that we come to feel for the whole world because we practice a trusting heart. And when he talks about bowing, he now cites words of Buddha. So here's what he says, quoting Buddha. This is Shakyamuni Buddha talking, as quoted by Dogen. In encountering teachers who expound unsurpassable enlightenment, do not consider their caste or facial appearance. Do not dislike their shortcomings or judge their activities. Just value their prajna and feed them daily with 100 or 1,000 ounces of gold. A little extravagant, but this was the way they talked in 12th century Japan. Offer them celestial meals. Sprinkle celestial flowers for them. Bow and pay respect to them 3 times a day, and do not arouse the mind of confusion. So this is like doing service 3 times a day, you know, like you do, bowing to the teacher and offering, you know, celestial incense and the things we offer at the altar. That's what he's talking about. If you act in this way, the path of enlightenment will surely be aroused. This is the way this is Buddha talking, this is the way I aroused the aspiration for enlightenment, and now I have attained unsurpassable complete enlightenment. Well, this is a little strange, because don't we understand that the Buddha is the originator of the tradition? Don't we all know the story of the Buddha? Well, he had different teachers, but they were not really sufficient, so he went off on his own. So he's the first teacher in a succession of teachers. He doesn't have a teacher, but here he says, I bow to all my teachers. So, how's that? Well, the idea of Buddha as a singular practitioner who went his own way and didn't have a teacher would have been an indecipherable idea to Dogen. For Dogen, Buddha was not the first. For Dogen, there could not have been a Buddha who didn't have a teacher. There was no first Buddha. There's only a beginningless and endless succession of Buddhas, each one passing on this torch of trust to the next. Because the trusting heart cannot be awakened alone. And so Buddha here is quoted as saying that he himself practiced reverence and bowing with his own teachers. And I don't know where this quotation comes from exactly, but I do know that Dogen doesn't make stuff up. Dogen is very faithful to the scriptures, so he gets this from some Mahayana sutras in which this is the teaching. This is not just Dogen who feels this way about Buddha. This is Mahayana Buddha's teaching about Buddha. And Dogen felt, along with all other Mahayana Buddhist teachers, that even though the Pali Canon seemed to be saying something different, it wasn't really saying something different. That later and earlier teachings were completely consistent with one another, but expressions were different depending on the mentality and the needs of the hearers. So Dogen was completely aware of the early teachings and, you know, the early idea that Buddha appeared to be the first, but he understood that this was only taught in that way at that time. for because of the people who are listening. And notice that Buddha says, don't pay any attention to the caste or appearance of the teacher. And this now is beginning to speak about the point I mentioned a minute ago, that we should fully respect everybody in the Dharma. And this gets us to the question of male and female teachers. Because now, the tone of the fastful shifts, and Dogen gets what I would say like pretty steamed up, you know, about this question of people not respecting all teachers, regardless of who they are, by being willing to bow to them. He's really upset about Buddhist monastics who will bow to some teachers who they think are worthy of respect and others who they don't. And he says here, however, foolish people who have never heard of Buddha Dharma, meaning other Buddhists, sorry, who call themselves great monks and would not bow to younger ones who have attained Dharma. Those who have matured practice over a long period of time, who would not bow to latecomers who have attained Dharma. Those who have certificates as masters, refusing to bow to others who don't have such certificates. Those who are in charge of Dharma matters, not bowing to other monks who have attained Dharma. Those who are, you know, bishops, high mucky-muck, big-shot priests, who don't bow to laymen and laywomen who have attained Dharma. Bodhisattvas of the 10 classes, of the 3 classes and the 10 stages, not bowing to nuns who have attained Dharma. Such foolish people have never seen or heard of the Buddhist way. So, this is so resonant for us in our contemporary lives. I think, you know, it's such an important point, not only for Dharma students, but for many people, to be concerned with justice, with gender and racial equality, and with the sense that there's no one who should not be respected. All of life, including non-human life, is worthy of bowing and deep respect. So Dogen is here castigating these people and saying, not only is this unfair and frankly rude, but not to accord everyone ultimate respect, regardless of whether you think they're important or not, violates the Dharma. If you can't respect and bow to all others, in other words, if you're so blinded by rank and status that you don't see who someone is, you really missed awakening. Next, Dogen quotes as an example of this kind of attitude, something of Zhaozhou, who famously went on pilgrimage to investigate the Dharma at the age of 60. After practicing for 40 years, he kind of started all over again as a novice, going around and talking to people, and he announced, as he went forth to do this, I will ask about the Dharma of anyone who surpasses me, even if it's a 7-year-old little girl. And I will also teach anyone who is behind me, even a 100-year-old monk. So this is interesting. Zhaozhou is saying that he will listen to anyone. He will accept teaching from anyone. He will respect everyone, listen to everyone, in order to hear the voice of the Dharma. But he's also saying that he is willing to teach anyone and willing to be listened to by anyone, even somebody who is presumably his elder or his superior. And to me, this is a beautiful saying of Zhaozhou and something that we can all aspire to. Really, it's saying that each one of us has our unique position because of our conditioning. Unique position and unique truth. All of us deserve to be listened to in this world. And there is no one to whom you do not owe respect. And you yourself are as worthy of respect as anyone else. In this whole world, there is no one that you are superior to. And in this whole world, there is no one who is superior to you. So bowing is our practice. Respecting others, listening to them, really and truly hearing them, being humble in this sense. Even as we understand that there's no one in this world who's more of a Buddha than you are. So we're always ready to help and guide others, if we're able. If you entered the Sangha last week, help the person who just came today. If you entered the Sangha decades ago, help the person who came last week. Life flows back and forth. Our positions constantly change. We live and die together. Sometimes it's your turn to live and my turn to die. And sometimes it's my turn to live and your turn to die. When we realize we're all in the same boat, you know, we're all in the same family. There's nothing to possess and no identity that we can hold on to as our own. All status and all differences are accidental and provisional. And when we know that, we can accept those differences as they really are, without disrespecting anyone. When we can do that, we will have peace and harmony. Dogen tells some teachers now about female and male teachers. And I want to tell you this one because I think it reminds me of Mountain Rain. This is about Zhishan, who was a male monastic. He became a disciple of Linji. When he first went to visit Linji, as he always did, you know, grabbed him by the lapels and shook him, and he said, I get it. And Linji said, okay, you can stay. And he stayed and became a disciple of Linji, but then he left Linji, and he went and studied with Moshan, who was a woman. And she said, where are you from? And he said, from the entrance. And she said, then why don't you close it off? And he bowed in respect and became her student. Then she said, then he asked her, how is Moshan? Because Moshan was the name of the mountain, Mount Mo. Which was her name. How is Mount Mo? She said, it does not show its peak. Who is the person inside the mountain? He asked her. And she said, it is beyond man and woman. And he said, how come you don't change then? Because some of you may know, there's in Mahayana Buddhism, it's kind of funny, but Mahayana Buddhism holds that both males and females are obviously can be equally can be awakened. But there's a little detail involved, which is that you can only actually fully attain awakening in a male body. So if you're a female and you're awakened, you just sort of like get reborn as a male. So just a little detail, not a problem. Just so he's saying to her, well, if there's no, if it's beyond male or female, how come you don't appear as a male? She says to him, I'm not a wild fox spirit. Why should I change? And he bowed to her again. And this is when his practice really turned. And he stayed with her 3 more years. And later, when he was abbot of his own monastery, he used to say, I received half a ladle at old man Linji's and half a ladle at old woman Moshan's, so I have a full ladle, and I feel satisfied. So this is a wonderful ancient precedent of something that is sort of commonplace in Mountain Range Sangha, right? You receive a ladle from one and a ladle from the other, and you have a full pot. And it's happening in other, this is not the only sangha in which you have a male and a female leader. And there are many, many women dharma teachers and many male dharma teachers. And so we are learning from one another and perhaps little by little completing and balancing the, for centuries, unbalanced practice that has existed in this world. And as time goes on, maybe we'll have other ladles from people of different backgrounds, social classes. I think we need all of that if we're really going to have a dharma that is true to Buddha's fundamental teaching. It takes a long time. We have to be more patient probably than we would like to be, but I trust it happens. I was also reminded from the story about what we now do in our everyday Zen family, when we offer precepts and we offer lineage. Now we have a lineage paper that has actually two documents in it. One is the traditional Kenshin Myaku, the blood vein, which has the lineage through linear time from Buddha to the present teacher, a lineage that is predominantly male. And we package this together with a document that is not linear but circular, which includes a lineage of all the women, not all the women, but exemplary women from the past into the present. And when we give the lineage paper, we now have some language like putting these two lineages together, we now have one complete lineage, Dharma heritage, in a way, for the first time in history. Dogen, later, just to end this, he, at the end of the fascicle, he really gets hysterical on this point. He says, why do you think men are so special? Emptiness is emptiness. 4 great elements are 4 great elements. 5 skandhas are 5 skandhas. Women somehow are not this. Men and women both attain the way. Honor that. Don't discriminate between men and women. This is the main principle of the Buddha way. And he rails against, there was, I guess this is probably the occasion for this writing this, is that there were male monastics in his day who felt that it was very virtuous, the height of virtue, to seclude themselves from women, either by taking a vow to never look at a woman. So if a woman appeared, you know, in the vicinity, they would look away and never look at the woman. Or they would live in special enclosures called secluded areas or pure areas in which a woman could never enter. And the trouble with women, why you shouldn't look at them and why you shouldn't allow them in your enclosure, is that they were going to tempt you to break precepts. It's their fault. This is seems ridiculous, but no, actually it was very common in male monastic establishments, not only in Asia, but also in the West. Dogen says, I mean, this is amazing that he's saying this in the 13th century. If we discriminate against women because we see them merely as objects of sexual desire, why don't we also discriminate against men for the same reason? Right? If you want causes for, you know, precept breaking, you don't need to go, you don't need to limit the objects that can be precept breaking to women. Men can be objects. Women can be objects. Those who are neither men nor women can be objects. Phantoms, fantasies, you know. Flower, you can look at a flower and get all excited, right? And flowers of emptiness. Flowers of emptiness could be the object. There were those who were trapped by impure conduct while looking at images in the water or gazing at the sun. Gods can be the objects. Demons can be the objects. They're countless, the objects that could cause us to become impure. There's countless, countless objects. So what are we going to do? Exclude all of them? And you know, we're our battles of the moment are about this, right? Let's exclude these people, like, you know, like in the United States, like, get these immigrants out of here. we have perfect, nice America. Who are these people? We don't know what they think from all these foreign places, different cultures. They don't even have our religion. Can't have that. Let us exclude the impure from our midst. And as Dogen says, where does that end? I think we kind of know where that is. Let's not do that. Bodhisattvas fully understand that if you exclude even one piece of dust, you cut the sky in half. And you cut your own heart in two. And once you start cutting, there's no end to it. So we practice bowing. We bow before the Dharma talk. I always appreciate that, you know. Because when I bow before the Dharma talk, I say to myself, thank you, Buddha, for this brilliant teaching. You're the one who's talking. I hope I don't mess it up for you. If I had to give a Dharma talk myself, it would be a mess. So I bow, and I get a lot of help. And then at the end, I bow again. Thank you, Buddha, for helping get me through that. So that's what we're doing when we practice bowing. We are creating an identity with an all-inclusive heart. and we are healing. Bowing is a very healing practice because every one of us has a heart of exclusion, right? Which we often turn against ourselves. You know, exclude someone else and you exclude yourself. So we bow to heal a heart of exclusion. Bowing is the practice of love and respect for the other, which means love and respect for the self, which means love and respect for the Buddha. Our practice is above all else the cultivation of a trusting heart. We can live in this world with a trusting heart, trusting everything. And we need that, not only for ourselves, but for the good of the whole world that is almost screaming, crying out for the trusting heart. Thank you very much for listening to my Dharma talk. I hope I didn't make you sit there too long and cause you too much discomfort. Thank you also for being here and for, it's just such a joy, as I said at the beginning, to return to physically experience with you the joy of this wonderful community. I mean, on the one hand, just a bunch of schmoes, wasting their time. Nobody needs to come and write an article about it for the newspaper, you know? It doesn't even appear in the newspaper. What is it? Nothing. On the other hand, what a tremendous thing. What a tremendous thing. So thank you.